Welcome back, Question Medicine 2020. This is Andrew Bill down here in sunny St. Petersburg, Florida. Another day, another dollar, another week, another podcast. You know the deal by now. We're going to get in what I'm getting on. We'll talk about what I'm reading about. And this is a weird week because it's a holiday week. So I'm not going to do the Question Medicine and normal stuff like I always do. But it is Thanksgiving, my friends. And I am thankful for you for listening to this podcast and continually questioning medicine. I really do appreciate your support, your listening. And if you find it helpful, as I say in every other podcast, please tell a friend, give a 5-star review. It really does help other people find the podcast. And with that being said, without any hesitation, without any reservation, it is good to be back. All right, here we go. Andrew Bilt, sunny St. Petersburg, Florida. Let's do this thing, shall we? Here's one thing I think we can all agree on, and that is that no one, and I mean no one, wants to get pregnant 2 minutes after having a baby. And I think we can also all agree that an IUD is the most effective form of contraception, unless you're just not having sex at all. But if you're going to have sex, IUD is the most effective form of contraception. However, placing an IUD after delivering a child seems to be a point of debate, as the risk of expulsion seems to be significantly higher immediately post-pregnancy. So in this study, titled Expulsion of Intrauterine Devices After Postpartum Placement by the Timing of Placement, Delivery Type, and Intrauterine Device Type, a systematic review and meta-analysis looked at this very issue. They looked at the different rates of IUD expulsion postpartum. Now, as you can imagine, the rates vary based on if the IUD was placed within 3 minutes of the child delivery or if it was placed 3 weeks after child delivery. There also seemed to be a difference between a hormonal IUD and a copper IUD. And finally, there was a difference on whether the woman had a C-section or a vaginal delivery. Now, as you can imagine, the vaginal delivery was associated with significantly more rates of expulsion because the C-section was associated with 0 to 2% rate of expulsion. I mean, it was almost nothing. So for the rest of this article, we're only going to talk about the rates of expulsion that were associated with a vaginal delivery. If you had a C-section, you could almost certainly put that IUD in right away. But if you had a vaginal delivery, this is when we got to be careful. They looked at two different kinds of IUD placement, the copper IUD, which goes by Paragard, and then progesterone IUD, which goes by Skyla, Lyletta, or Mirena. But in this study, they only used papers that looked at Mirena. So consider that when you're placing your IUD. However, I think these results likely are going to be pretty similar for all of the hormonal IUDs. Ultimately, the authors looked at three different time frames for the placement of the IUD. One time frame was immediate placement within 10 minutes postpartum. So baby comes out, boom, IUD goes in. There we go. Bam, bam, thank you, ma'am. The next one was IUD placement anywhere from 10 minutes to 72 hours postpartum, which is baby comes out. We maybe let you go back to your room, but then we put it in the next day before discharge or 2 days later before discharge from the hospital. And then they looked at 72 hours to 4 weeks postpartum, somewhere in the outpatient setting, placement of this IUD. Let's break down these time frames, shall we? Well, individuals who had an IUD placed immediately following delivery, baby comes out, IUD goes in, had very high expulsion rates, 27% with the Mirena and 12% with Paragard. For me, that's way too high of a risk for expulsion to ever justify doing that. I mean, other than a clinical study, why would we do that? What about the individuals who had an IUD placed not immediately, not within the first 5-10 minutes, but soon thereafter, maybe 24, 48, up to 72 hours following delivery? Well, expulsion rate, 37%. We're going up. We're getting worse. And that was with the hormonal IUD and still 7% with the copper IUD. So we're looking at roughly here 30% expulsion rate if you either had it with a hormonal IUD, if you had that placed basically any time during your hospital stay, whether it was within 10 minutes or within 10 hours or 72 hours, that you're looking at 27 to 37% risk of expulsion if you put in a progesterone Mirena IUD, and around 10% if you had a copper IUD. That still seems really high and hard to justify, or at least hard to justify in my mind. But what about the women? What about the women that followed up in the outpatient clinic? Well, there was no expulsion that occurred for either the hormonal or the copper IUDs in this systematic review and meta-analysis. No expulsion occurred if you had your IUD placed within 72 hours to 4 weeks after child delivery. I think the final answer here is for women who have a vaginal delivery and would like an IUD placement following delivery, there is almost no way we can justify placing hormonal IUDs within the first 72 hours, as the expulsion rate of 30-ish% is way too high to justify. The ideal situation would be an IUD placement in the outpatient setting sometime between 72 hours and 4 weeks. However, if your patient is insisting on IUD placement while still in the hospital, then it appears the best option would be a copper IUD, and this likely should be placed as close to discharge as possible, because even those individuals who had a copper IUD placed prior to 72 hours still had a 7% expulsion rate, which to me still seems too high to justify. Now, if you are going to use this paper in your practice, I think there is one really important detail you have to remember. You must remember, and that is that this was all for vaginal deliveries, not for C-sections. If you had a C-section, your rate of expulsion was basically 0%. Go ahead, put the IUD in prior to hospital discharge. There you have it. Now, our next article that I want to talk about is a very irritating article, and it is because it talks about a very irritating condition to treat. And of course, that must mean that I'm talking about irritating bowel syndrome, also known as irritable bowel syndrome, in this randomized double-blind placebo-controlled trial titled Randomized Clinical Trial, Misopride versus Placebo for Irritable Bowel Syndrome with Predominant Constipation. And in this study, the authors took just over 400 patients with severe irritable bowel syndrome, predominant constipation, who were having less than 3 spontaneous bowel movements per week. Think about that, less than 3 per week. And per the Rome criteria, these people were having significant amount of pain and discomfort associated with their bowel movements. Now, they were either placed on placebo or the active arm, 10 milligrams, 20 milligrams, 40 milligrams daily for 3 months, and the primary endpoint was an increase in one or more complete spontaneous bowel movement. And in the end, it didn't matter what dose of Misopride you got or if you got placebo, it didn't matter. All groups had an improvement of about 40% in their rates of spontaneous bowel movements. Yes, that is right. Irritable bowel syndrome is frustrating. It's irritating to treat because pooping and bowel movements are so mental. Anxiety, stress, and tension can back you up like the Hoover Dam, and then a magical pill, even if it's placebo, can put you at ease and open the floodgates, my friend. Running a trial is hard because you have to beat placebo, and in this study, placebo showed almost a 40% improvement in the outcome that you're looking for. I mean, think how good your drug has to be to not only beat placebo, but it beats placebo that is already giving a 40% improvement. So it has to almost show a 60% improvement. That is a really hard thing to do. So when I talk about studies that can't beat placebo, or I talk about drugs that can't beat placebo, don't think that it's the drug can't do anything. It's just that it can't beat placebo. And with that, I think we should move on to the next article, which also couldn't beat placebo. It is a paper titled Effect of Platelet-Rich Plasma, also known as PRP, on Non-Surgically Treated Acute Achilles Tendon Ruptures, a randomized double-blind prospective study. This was in the American Journal of Sports Medicine, and it looked to see if PRP, platelet-rich plasma, could beat placebo in the treatment of acute Achilles tendon rupture. In this randomized double-blind placebo-controlled trial of 40 patients with acute Achilles rupture confirmed on ultrasound, all patients were treated with a continuously worn ankle cast that kept the foot Planner Flex for 8 weeks. And then every 2 weeks, the researchers lessen the degree of plantar flexion. After 9 weeks, all patients began an ankle rehabilitation program. But half of these individuals were randomized to placebo or PRP injections. The patients were injected every 2 weeks. So every 2 weeks, you'd come in and you would get an injection. You didn't know what kind of injection you were getting. And then the researchers would also change the cast that you were wearing, so it was a less degree of plantar flexion. The authors then evaluated patient function via the Achilles tendon total rupture score at the time of removing the cast, and then again at 3 months, 4.5 months, 6, 9, and 12 months following injury. And surprise, surprise, in the end, there was no difference whether the patient was randomized to receive platelet-rich plasma injections or saline injections. Granted, this study was only 40 patients, and it was way too small to determine the difference, such as the re-rupture rate, but this was a really well-done study that I think is really hard to refute the findings for. They did a lot of things exactly how you would want to see them done. For example, none of the patients, nor the providers, nor the statisticians, nor the outcome assessors were aware whether the patient had received saline or platelet-rich plasma. Usually in these trials, someone somewhere kind of knows what the person is getting, but not in this one. They were very careful in making sure that no one had any idea what was being done. There is only one person who did the injections. So you can't say, well, maybe this is, you know, injection independent. No, it was only one person that did all the injections. And this was an experienced sports medicine physician, and they injected all patients under ultrasound. But this provider had no influence and didn't know the patient's outcome, was not affected with the patient's care. This person only came in, was completely blinded, and gave the injection. And that person didn't know whether the person got PRP or normal saline because there was a sheath that was placed over the syringe to the hub of the needle. There you have it, completely blinded. No one knows what you're getting. This, in all actuality, was a very, very well done trial, and the method section was one of the most sound method sections of any trial I've read in a really long time. If you have 2 minutes of time, you should go to this trial and just read their method section so you know a perfect example of how all method sections should be written. The methods were given in such extreme detail, right down to the exact gauge of the needle that they were using and the brand of ultrasound machine that they were using. If you doubt this trial, then there is enough information just in the method section that you could easily repeat it in your own office tomorrow without any questions. You could just rerun the trial in your office. All you'd need is 40 patients with an acute Achilles tendon rupture. But if you can't run this trial, then I think we have to say at this point that placebo is not nothing. Placebo is really hard to beat, especially if you're trying to treat with platelet-rich plasma for an Achilles tendon rupture. It's really hard to beat placebo. Let's move on to the next article. You may have noticed, or you might have noticed, that I spent a long time in that last paper talking about the method section and how it was really well done. And if you disagree with the results or the outcome, then you can repeat the study yourself in your clinic. I have noticed that when it comes to the literature, some people have a strong belief about the findings, like in the vitamin D literature and other such literature, which is borderline terrible. Those individuals who believe in something so powerful, such as, I don't know, a mask, refuse to believe the outcome of a well-done trial, regardless of how well the trial was done. However, the most important part of a paper, besides for the results section, is the methods section. You need to know exactly what they're doing. You need to know the gauge of needle, the size of the syringe, the lab assay used, the number of years experience of the provider giving the intervention has to almost be the exact same. And if you have all the information in the methods section, then you, yes, you yourself can rerun the exact same study. And Sometimes, if you don't have all that information, you might rerun the exact same study, but your lab might be off or your results might be off just a little bit based on what you would have never ever expected. And that is no more clearly seen than in this next paper titled Strict Pre-Analytical Oral Glucose Tolerance Test Blood Sample Handling is Essential for Diagnosing Gestational Diabetes Mellitus. In this paper, the authors looked at the effect of processing the oral glucose tolerance test with either a delayed or an early centrifuge protocol. There is or was a total of just over 12,000 women in this study. Approximately 7,000 women received a delayed centrifuge protocol, and right around 5,000 women received an early centrifuge protocol. The women that had the delayed centrifuge protocol had their blood collected, but then the blood was sent off to a faraway central lab for blood glucose analysis. Those that had an early centrifuge protocol underwent the same oral glucose tolerance testing, but when they had their blood drawn for analysis, the blood glucose testing was performed immediately right there on site. All things being equal, there really shouldn't be much of a difference here. It should be the exact same whether you do it in-house or you send it out somewhere to a central laboratory. And if they didn't mention in the method section where they had done this sampling, or if they didn't mention in the method section the type of maybe machine or assay that they were using, well then you just might rerun this study and get completely different results. Because when they looked at the results, it turned out that those individuals who had immediate glucose testing had twice the rate of diagnosed gestational diabetes than those individuals with delayed glucose testing. If you had just took the fasting analysis, there was a difference of 4 milligrams per deciliter. At 1 hour sample, there was a difference of 6 milligrams per deciliter, and at the 2 hour sample, there was a difference of 3 milligrams per deciliter. This may sound very small, and I agree, it is very small. But in the overall scheme of things, it's quite large. Remember that the fasting blood glucose concentration for the diagnosis of gestational diabetes is less than 95. So a difference of 4 just based on a higher lab value, just based on lab processing, just based on sending the blood from one area to another area, that difference is a really big difference. Almost a 5% error in the test. Likely in the United States for many oral glucose tolerance tests, we use AccuCheck monitors, and this probably is not an issue. However, the same question is really important for us here in America in our AccuCheck monitors. How well are the AccuCheck monitors calibrated? How often are they calibrated? And what's the accuracy between monitors? If you use one monitor and then a different brand monitor, are you getting the exact same results? If you're off by 4 or 5, that can drastically throw off your results. And in this study, it doubled the chance that you would be diagnosed with gestational diabetes. We have to keep in mind and make sure that our patients are also aware of the inconsistencies and the large number needed to treat for most of our practices. If the patient didn't know that the lab value could be off by 4 or 5, they're then walking out of your office with a diagnosis that they can't believe. I mean, they thought, oh my goodness, no way. I never thought that I had gestational diabetes. And they probably didn't have gestational diabetes. They just had an improperly run lab assay. That is clearly seen in this paper, and is clearly seen in this very last paper, which is titled, Your Results May Vary, The Imprecision of Medical Measurements. This is in the BMJ, which looked at the variation or error that surrounds laboratory testing. This paper found much of what I have previously mentioned on Questioning Medicine about laboratory findings, such as a single hemoglobin A1C test results from 6.3 could actually be as low as maybe 5.5 or as high as 7.1. The lab findings that we take every day are thrown off by variability in the analytical or lab process, as well as the biological variability, meaning the variation within the same person over the course of a day just caused by normal physiological changes. The hemoglobin A1C, the LDL, all this may be different in the morning than it is at night, may be different at noon than it is at midnight. All the different changes may be different on a Monday compared to a Wednesday. These changes in combination will throw off your lab test, and there should be, I wish that there was, 95% confidence intervals off to the side of each test, so you'd actually know how inaccurate or imprecise many of the tests that we often order actually are. Combined, these imprecisions can make it very challenging if you're not aware of them. For example, a single iron, bilirubin, or triglyceride level can be as inaccurate as much as 50%. 50% of the value that you're looking at could be either way, higher or lower. You don't really know. That means you would require at least a 50% change in the level to be considered a true, valid, actual change and not just a statistical variability. This paper comes with a calculator that I think everyone should use, and I've put a link to it in the details of this podcast. It's going to be the very first link right there. You should click on it, save it to your favorites, because it's a great reminder of how inaccurate or imprecise many of our studies or our lab tests actually are. And with that, let's recap the articles we've talked about today before this ship sets sail in the sea of evidence. If you have a woman that wants an IUD following pregnancy, well, then tell her her best bet is to wait till after the vaginal delivery and wait somewhere between 72 hours, 3 days, and 3 weeks. That's the best time, 3 days and 3 weeks. But if they're having a C-section, then the risk of expulsion for the IUD is almost nothing. So go ahead and put it in before they leave the hospital. And with that, it is irritating. It is irritating. It is irritating to treat irritable bowel because placebo sometimes works up to 40% of the time. And it's really irritating to beat placebo if you are PRP and in a double-blinded randomized controlled trial trying to beat placebo for Achilles rupture. In the study that I found that was one of the most well-done studies I've ever seen, it could not do it. And do not forget, the results of your test are going to vary. They're going to vary just based on the lab assay. They're going to vary based on how frequently or how quickly you do the test. They're going to vary. You need to be aware of these variations and these imprecisions so you can have a better shared decision-making conversation with the patient sitting in front of you and understand that just because the test says what the test says that it says, it doesn't mean that it actually says what it says. It could say about anything else within the 95% confidence interval, which for some tests is a very wide margin. And with that, I'm going to end this podcast as I've ended every podcast before it. Wait for the music. And until next time, keep the quest and questioning.